No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. And tonight we have a great guest. Her name is Dr. Sarah Kendzior, and Dr. Kendzior has written several books, A View from Flyover Country, Dispatches from a Forgotten America, Hiding in Plain Sight, The Invention of Donald Trump and the Erosion of America. We really want to talk about that. And They Knew, How a Culture of Conspiracy Keeps America Complacent. Dr. Kendzior has a PhD in anthropology from Washington University in St. Louis, a very good school, where she researched politics and digital media in authoritarian states and the former Soviet Union. And we welcome you to the show, Doctor. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you, and let's start at the beginning. I've got to tell you, Doctor, everybody in my family called me in 2016. They were worried about Donald Trump getting elected. And I said to him, don't be crazy. This man can't get elected. Nobody's going to vote for him. The only good thing I can say about it is they no longer ask for my political opinion. How the hell did that happen? How did we get Donald Trump?
I mean, I thought he would get elected for a number of reasons. I mean, one of them is that I live in a part of the country where I did see genuine enthusiasm for him from Missouri. And that was in part because people had a very misleading idea of who he was. They knew him from The Apprentice. They knew him from a media makeover. And a lot of the history of his financial crimes, of his ties to the mafia, of his very serious offenses were not being covered by the mainstream media. They were effectively being buried, and Trump's army of lawyers was helping do that. The other thing, of course, I thought that would help him win was, you know, those very ties, that army of lawyers, you know, those transnational organized crime ties, because, you know, those sorts of people are the type who know how to illicitly influence an election. You know, when you bring somebody like Paul Manafort on to run your campaign, somebody who's illicitly, you know, won, I guess I could say euphemistically, elections in Ukraine and elsewhere, you know, you're doing that for particular reason. And I got very worried that our officials and institutions were not sounding the alarm on Trump as a threat to American public safety and national security. You know, they were treating him like entertainment. They were treating him like a joke. And Trump ran with it. He's a demagogue. He's very entertaining. He's very good, I think, at making people underestimate him as a serious opponent. And then, you know, you can get into the whole weaknesses of the Hillary Clinton and her campaign as well, but it was just a real perfect storm of a lot of bad situations.
Yeah, it certainly was. And, you know, and it's funny that you're in Missouri. Missouri is the last place that I campaigned for Obama. And Obama, when he first ran in Missouri, ran to a tie. I mean, it took Missouri was the last state that they declared he barely lost it. We were shocked because we see Missouri as a red state, you know, but that's really surprising that they've gone from him to Trump. That's just amazing to me. And it's amazing that the mainstream media didn't cover more of this stuff. I mean, the guy has never succeeded in anything. You know, he's failed at every company he's ever brought. He's he drove many small business people in Atlantic City into bankruptcy. You know, he's, I said to the Washington Post one time, I've done exactly what Trump has done in his life. And they said, how's that? And I said, I took the fortune my father left me and I increased it 1,000-fold. I said, the only difference is my father left me $25, you know, and that's a big difference, right? You know, you get to start with $100 million back when $100 million was worth something. And, yeah, he's just, and when you talk, he's got a great political sense. You know, when he was shot, and I mean, thank God he wasn't killed or seriously injured, but when he was shot, to stand up and raise his hand and, you know, pump a fist, man, that's right out of the politician's handbook on how to deal with a situation like that. You know,
absolutely.
That, perfect response for that, you know, and I swear I've had bigger pimples than he had a wound on his ear. I mean, it was just amazing that happened. But he played it perfectly, and Republicans need to do that. You know, I seem to have the ability to do that. I remember when I worked for Jimmy Carter, and I remember when Ronald Reagan got shot. When they were wheeling him into the operating room with a bullet in him, he looked up at the doctors and said, I hope you guys are all Republicans. And I thought to myself, you know, that's what John Wayne would say, right, in a movie when they were taking him in after he'd been wounded. So he does have a great political sense. But beyond that, let me ask you something. Is there a gap in America that he filled somehow? Because I keep on having that feeling as Democrats, you talked about Hillary's campaign for a second, that we left the door open for this guy. You know, so what do you feel about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I felt that way more strongly in 2016. You know, I was very worried about the direction the country was going because I felt like we had never really recovered from the recession. I felt like it was an unequal recovery. I was seeing all around me people who were unemployed, who were partially employed, and who were full of rage, in part because Democratic officials kept telling them that everything was actually fine, you know, that we had recovered, that America was on the way up, and folks didn't feel that. And you know, Trump was able to tap into that, but, you know, note the selectivity of what he tapped into there. You know, it was white voters. There's a huge right. racial element to this, whereas in terms of who was hit economically, you know, it was white people, black people, Latino people, like every race was affected by the downfall of the U.S. economy in the 2008 collapse. But generally speaking, it was white people who, you know, turned to Trump as a sort of demagogue support system and who voted for Trump. Since then, you know, since that election, so much has happened to this country with COVID, with the January 6th attack, with an endless array of corruption, scandals and crimes and institutional failures to bring repercussions for them, with Biden stepping down. I mean, you could just go through the last 30 days and you've got like right. a decade's worth of news stories that are so seminal. It's like I worry sometimes people almost forget they happened. And then, of course, you have huge changes there. Like some of the biggest changes have been in media and in how people access news and how they get beyond paywalls and what kind of information they're receiving and how they process it. I think it's led to a very confused country, a very scared country, I think, for a lot of valid reasons. Things have steadily gone downhill. I think, though, that if you had asked people in 2021, is Donald Trump going to be the presidential candidate again in 2024 after facing no serious repercussions for any of his crimes? You know, even the most pessimistic people have said, no, of course not. You know, certainly something will happen to at least contain him and prevent him from running a campaign since he has confessed to a number of these crimes and committed them in the open. And so my question always is, you know, why are our institutions, in particular the DOJ, allowing him to get away with this? And why did they let him get away with a lifetime of organized crime activity in New York through all of his real estate dealings, which were often mafia fronts, you know, money laundering fronts? You know, he was connected to the Russian mafia, to the Italian mafia. And this isn't stuff that's theoretical. This was documented in real time. Like, if you lived in the East Coast in the 1980s or 1990s, you could read about Trump and all of this in mainstream papers, in, you know, whether it was tabloids or Spy magazine or Vanity Fair or so forth. And something very strange happened in 2016 where suddenly the mainstream media went very quiet about all that stuff that was in the public domain, which I remembered from my childhood, because that's how deep it went, is that Trump being, you know, a fraud, committing financial fraud, committing tax fraud, those were plots of children's TV shows. They had characters on Sesame Street modeled after him, and we were all supposed to instantly know this. Like, we were just supposed to know Donald Trump is a criminal, and that's just a basic fact of American life. Like, you know, really kind of, you know, Ronald Reagan likes the jelly beans level of knowledge for children. And to have this guy presented again, you know, with this huge makeover due to reality TV and so forth, as anything close to a legitimate candidate without any of these issues really brought up in a serious way was astounding. And I did talk to a number of journalists from that older era at the time in 2016, and they told me all their stories were censored. They were trying to get this information back into places like the Washington Post, the New York Times, and they didn't want that. They were fine with printing scandal about Trump, but they didn't want to examine serious crimes that would then bring about potentially serious penalties. And I think that that's an interesting and sad tale.
It is. And you know what? We had a New York Times reporter on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he said one of his fears in life was that there's so much competition in the media now that they have to play to sponsors. So he said, you know, he really doesn't think that you're going to get money from for ads for like Remington and Colt and, you know, manufacturers like that, and then write a bad story about gun control. You know, he said he really worries about the infiltration of corporations into media and their control over the process. Do you think that is that an ongoing problem that we're going to have to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I wrote in my last book was our media is dictated by sponsored and sponsored by dictators. And that's, you know, basically what it feels like. You know, it's not like there's this straightforward top-down censorship from the state, but I think people deal with matters of self-censorship and just refusing to report stories in order to appease, you know, corporate backers, as you just mentioned, but also political backers. And I think those lines have become very blurry. You know, I think the lines between transnational organized crime, corporate crime, and our government have all blurred in such a fashion that, you know, the repercussions, for example, of talking about the NRA will then, you know, go back to the donations that the NRA gives to a political candidate, which then lead to other donations that, you know, a foreign nation may be giving the same candidate through a proxy, and all these complicated maneuvers. And all of these people, I think, are both intimidating themselves, but they're also scared of each other. You know, they live in constant fear of, you know, what could happen to them because they're constantly surrounded by bad people. It leads to a climate of fear. And that's what we've been in for a long time. I think a lot of our officials are afraid to speak out about it, even though that climate of fear has led to a climate of violence that you see in, you know, all sorts of ways, whether you look at January 6th or you look at, you know, the incident with Trump being the target of an assassin, you know, or other officials facing threats. Like, this has been steadily building for a long time. You know, I am worried it's going to overflow this year. I really hope it doesn't. But that, it seeps into everything, into media, into people's private lives, into how they express themselves on social media. And it's a shame, because, you know, one thing I always did appreciate growing up here, you know, and having visited authoritarian regimes where people are deeply afraid to speak out, to criticize their government and so forth, is that I felt like I could do that without fear of, you know, imminent arrest or even meaningful harassment, from the government. And I feel that less and less. I mean, that's just a result of my own profile rising. But I know folks, you know, who aren't like well known in any way, and they feel the same kind of thing from because of social media, because of that kind of online presence that can instantly turn into like a mob of strangers attacking you. People feel watched, they feel surveilled, and that's a very unhealthy thing for a democracy.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I spoke in a few years ago in India, and one thing that shocked them was my ability to talk about Donald Trump. They wanted to talk about Donald Trump, but they have a guy named Modi, who you may be familiar with, mm-hmm. and they're afraid to say anything. They're afraid to say anything in public, even though we were at a conference of leaders who were supposed to be talking about world problems. They wouldn't say anything to me. In fact, it was a young woman who I could tell wanted to talk to me about things, but it took her 3 or 4 days of me being there before she felt comfortable to sit down and have a private conversation with me about what was going on. She was a doctor, and she was she was from an area in India which had just been shut down by Modi. It was mostly Muslim, and he cut off all communications, cut off the electricity. He's horrible. But it really shocked them that I was able to speak freely about this guy when they were just terrified. And these were all well-educated, top people. So what you're saying is very true. And I hope that, we find a way to combat this feeling that we're always being surveilled and we're always in jeopardy. But let me ask you, I want you to respond to this quote that I read in the Portland, Maine Press Herald. Somebody wrote, "The old world is dying and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time for monsters." What do you think about that? Do you think we've created an environment that makes it easier for these guys to come to power? I know that when they studied authoritarianism after the Second World War and they studied Germany and Italy, the fascist movements, there was considerable research that said it was the perfect environment in Germany for a guy like Hitler to rise. Have we created the perfect environment here in America for Trump?
I mean, I think in some ways, and I think that the quote I think is from Antonio Gramsci, who is an Italian, and studying fascism and studying, Mussolini and all of these dark impulses. And I do often feel like we are between these two worlds, and there's so many factors that are contributing to that because, in the past, when people have dealt with authoritarian regimes, their conception of the past and the future and what possibilities lie ahead was really different for a couple of reasons. And I think, one of them is climate change and ecological disasters, which we know we're facing the future and we're facing right now in the present. And it's, creating a rebound effect of all of these problems of poverty, migration, food shortages, housing shortages, all these things. This is just going to get worse. So it becomes harder to envision that future. I think then we have weird things going on with digital media. We have AI and we have all of these Silicon Valley tech gurus creating what to me feels like a really dystopian future that they seek to impose on other people against their will. I don't know a lot of folks who are enthused about this. I think people are very hungry for human connection and for honesty and transparency, and this all seems to go against that. You want to know who you're talking to. You don't want to talk to a robot, etc. Right. And so, there's this real difficulty, and I hear it all the time from people, who are struggling with issues of how do I raise my children or do I want to bring children into this world? And, it's all very hard questions to answer, but I think, the way through is to, be in touch with your humanity, with your imagination, with things that none of these dark forces can control, whether they're political forces, whether they are forces from Silicon Valley, all these folks that want to try to get inside your head, you know, to be unique and inscrutable and compassionate and kind of beyond the realm of like what a machine could possibly replicate. I think that that's a good way to be an anti-fascist, but it's also just kind of a good way to live life, like on your own terms, according to your own values and morals, because no one can take that from you. You know, when they threw Gramsci in jail, when they throw anybody in jail for their rights, you know, I mean, against their rights and because of their beliefs, they can't get to that moral center of an individual. You know, they can take everything else away, but they can't change who you are inside. And so that's just something to hold on to. And then, you know, as for the new world being born and what that's going to look like, I don't know, but I'm glad that at least people are reckoning with it in a serious way, you know, and trying to figure that out instead of just assuming it's going to work itself out on its own, because that I do not think is going to happen.
Well, first of all, let me tell you, I'm very impressed, Doctor, that you knew where that quote came from, because I'd never heard of the guy before. And so that's why I didn't use his name. I'm like, I don't know who this guy is, but it's a really profound quote, you know, so I'm very impressed by you. But let me ask you, let's move on to what's going on now. He seems to be struggling with Kamala Harris, and the media is portraying this as the his campaign being caught flat-footed because they were going after Joe Biden, and now they don't know how to switch gears. But is there also an element of the fact of Trump has a hard time dealing with women? I mean, his opinion of women is obviously not the highest, and you think that's a problem for him? Is he going to have a problem dealing with her because of who she is?
I think so. I mean, with her in particular, because Hillary Clinton had a different kind of demeanor, and, you know, and she was the first woman to run as the candidate. And, you know, so we've kind of been through this before. We've seen what these sexist attacks look like. You know, Kamala Harris is more familiar with it. So there's sort of an advantage in that, you know, she's the second person coming into this position. I do think he was taken aback by Biden dropping out. I don't think that the campaign necessarily anticipated this. I think they are also, you know, surprised that their attacks based on race and gender are not really sticking. And a lot of this is because, you know, Trump managed to gain traction in 2016 through shock value, through saying a lot of things that, you know, people were certainly thinking, you know, a lot of bigoted sentiment. But there was back then, you know, more of a reluctance to say things like that out loud because you would face actual professional penalties for it or social ostracization or so forth. And now we're just so used to it. You know, we hear him and so many other people say terrible things like that all the time that it's lost its shock value, which is a bad thing. But perversely, for Trump, you know, it's hurting him. You know, he says these things and everyone just kind of rolls their eyes and they're like, oh, great. You know, here he goes again. Now he's saying right. He's not black. Like, you know, it seems ridiculous. It seems trifling. What worries me is that this is such a low effort campaign at this point from Trump. I don't know whether he just thought his assassination thing would really clinch it, you know, because they did pause and he looked for his shoes and then he lifted his fist and he did the perfect photo and maybe he thought he had it in the bag. But, you know, now he doesn't seem to be trying hard. And my theory about that is that they don't plan to win the election, like win hearts and minds or convince people or so forth. They plan to steal the election through the courts, because that has been who's always helped Trump through all of his difficulties, not just as president, but, you know, in his life. And when he was president, he was able to pack the courts with lackeys who would support him no matter what he did. And then, of course, we have some precedent with Bush versus Gore, you know, where the matter of who the president is was ultimately decided by the Supreme Court. And we've just seen the Supreme Court give Trump the power of kings, you know, like he's this kind of incredible permanent immunity. So if I were Trump, I would just be kind of coasting through thinking, you know, I just got to get through the next 90 days or so, and then I'll let the courts duke it out for the next few months. And that's where I'm worried, because I feel like we've already seen violence stemming from that situation, low-level people were punished for that violence, kind of random Americans who got sucked into the morass, who I don't think necessarily knew what they were getting into because they were being told by Trump, yeah, this is legal, this is fine, you are totally expected to storm the Capitol, it's cool, nothing will happen to you. You know, I watched his goons on Twitter tell people this. Tell people who are worried about the repercussions of this that they would be protected, and they weren't. And of course, they shouldn't have done it, but still, they were misled. Whereas the top guys, people like Trump and Michael Flynn and so forth, they got off scot-free, and they're still out there, and they're planning, you know, coup two, the sequel. And I'm really worried that there does not seem to be, to my knowledge, any Democratic plan about how to fend off a possible second coup, or what happens if states, for example, refuse to certify the vote if Kamala Harris is the winner. They may just say, well, no, you're not. And a lot of folks don't think that's possible. But, you know, I live in Missouri where we vote for things all the time. And as a state, you know, for example, we voted almost unanimously to get rid of dark money in politics, like dirty money from anonymous donors and so forth. And then our GOP legislature said, we don't care. Like, we just don't care that you voted for that. We're just going to get rid of that and violate the law all the time and pretend that none of that happened. And we're all kind of like, wait, we voted for it. Like, how are you just throwing away our will? But that's what they do. They just truly don't care that we know that they're throwing it away. And there's like an audacity there that wasn't there before. And so I'm worried that that will be there. And they'll just be like, yeah, we know that you all voted for Kamala, but we don't care. We're going to make Trump anyway, or Trump or Vance. I mean, there's a small part of me that kind of wonders, is Trump going to make it through this cycle, just kind of based on his age, his health, his demeanor, and so forth. And also, I don't think he likes the work of being the president. I think he just likes running for president, you know? He likes giving those speeches, getting the applause, but having to live in the White House again, like, I just don't think he wants to do it, whereas J.D. Vance is very hungry for that. And I could kind of see a situation where Trump is like, all right, you know, I got you in here. Now you and Peter Thiel and the rest of the Silicon Valley guys can get to work on your godforsaken ambitions for this country. So,
well, you know, I mean, it really surprises me. You know, you mentioned the climate. We're all worried about the climate, right? We see California constantly on fire and Florida sinking into the ocean. We're all 100-degree days consecutively all over the damn place. We're all worried about the environment, and yet we got a guy saying drill baby drill who's getting supported, you know, like we don't understand that it's been hydrocarbons that have put us in this position. By the way, I just want to point out, when you say you talk to people and they're reticent about having children and what the future is, there was just a poll done. 47% of U.S. adults between 18 and 49 say they are unlikely to have children in the future, and that's up 10% just from 2018. So that's a real concern out there, and I wonder, you know, if we're doing anything as Democrats to ameliorate that. And I've got to tell you, I look at what Trump is doing as far as his campaign is going when it comes to doing things like playing the race card. As somebody that's worked on 6 presidential campaigns, I would be saying to him, don't do that. Don't play to your base. You're going to get 47% of the vote, and Kamala Harris is going to get 47% of the vote. You need to worry about the 6% of the people that haven't decided what they're going to do, and you're not trying to reach out to any of them. I mean, I noticed that he puts 5 black people behind him in every speech he makes. But, you know, when they pan out to the audience at the Republican convention, you've got to look hard to see a person of color, right? They're all white. And you know, I don't know why we're so easily fooled by this guy. Now, my father was a con man. Every time I look at Donald Trump, I see my dad. He could take money from people, because he could look you, hold your hand and look into your eyes and say, Sarah, I promise you're going to get every penny of this back. This is a great business deal, all the time, knowing that he was going to rob you. And most people responded to that because they couldn't do it. You know,
right.
they couldn't look at somebody and say that with sincerity when they knew it wasn't true. And so I get it a little bit, but I don't know how we've got this kind of mass hysteria going on in America where 47% of us support this guy. Half the country supports him, even if we win. Half the country supports him. What do you think about that? A lot of people are worried about that. We just heard from somebody the other night who said she was going to vote for Trump because she was afraid there'd be a civil war if he doesn't win.
Yeah.
I mean, how crazy is that?
I think it's less than half the country because half the country doesn't vote. You know, a lot of people are just completely disillusioned and tuned out. And then you get from that, you know, like most people at this point are not registered in any party. And that includes me. Like, I'm just an independent. I tend to vote Democratic because I live in Missouri. So, I mean, what am I going to do? Vote for Josh Hawley? I mean, come on. You know, so I'm voting for the Democrats. But I'm an independent. And that's true of most people. And I think that disillusionment is great. And I think that Trump's base of support is very low. And his voters are often voting purely because they hate the Democrats so much, or they believe a lot of the stuff that maybe like Fox News or other outlets are telling them about what the Democrats are going to do, which is usually, you know, way more vigorous than anything the Democrats actually do. You know, the problem is that the Democrats don't really fight back on these issues hard enough. They're very wishy-washy, whereas this weird image is created of them as, you know, they're out to get you and blah, blah, blah. Like they're so disorganized, at least until very recently, that they're not really accomplishing much of anything. I do think there is this fanatical Trump base that obviously can cause a lot of problems, because it doesn't take a lot of people to cause a lot of problems, especially if they resort to something like militancy or domestic terrorism or so forth. And the thing that really amazes me is just Trump's longevity, that he hasn't been replaced by somebody else, that he's been, you know, the first time he was investigated by the DOJ, it was before I was born, you know, it was in 1973. So we're at like the half centennial of Trump committing crimes, like unimpeded by any kind of institution. And who allows that, who backs that, and who protects him from repercussions, I think is a very interesting question, because you kind of see it through all these court systems. You see it with foreign countries. You see it with different presidential leaderships. They always let him off the hook, and they let him rise into the top. And so I'm more afraid of those sort of elite power brokers than I am of kind of the random Trump fan on the street. You know, like I kind of meet them in Missouri and they don't know who I am and they'll talk to me. And it's like they're not quite as enthused as I think folks think they are. I think there's an impression that you know, folks have of everyone sitting around thinking about Donald Trump all the time. They're really not. It's more what I do see, though, is like a real loathing for the Democratic establishment. Like that to me seems more intense than them liking Trump. Trump's just the guy they put up with to get rid of what's often kind of a mythical idea of what the Democrats are doing that doesn't really seem to me to reflect what the Democrats are doing. I am unhappy with the Democrats for different reasons, but like the ones they come up with, they just seem to come purely out of like Tucker Carlson or Fox or somebody else creating like a boogeyman kind of Democrat that isn't, you know, really active.
Well, you know, I felt that right from the beginning. I thought that, but this is all like, when the French threw their shoes into the machinery, right? And we get the word sabotage from that they tried to shut down the factories because they felt that it was the only recourse they had was to revolt. And, you know, I felt that sentiment against the Democrats for a long time, you know, that we talk down to people, for example. You know, that we say to women that don't have a college education, you don't matter. That we say to blue-collar workers. I mean, I'm a former Teamster, and I do not understand how the head of the Teamsters union goes to the Republican convention and speaks on behalf of Trump. It just totally eludes me how a guy that's never had a job in his life and was born with a silver spoon in his mouth and is a billionaire can convince working class people that he feels their pain. And the only thing I could come up with is, yeah, they don't like the Democrats.
Yeah, you know, I think they feel let down. It's like that that feeling of betrayal, like when you think that someone's got your back and you think that you can trust them and they're making a lot of promises to you, and then they screw you over in the same way that, say, the Republicans are going to screw you over, but you expect it from the Republicans. You kind of assume it's coming. And then when it comes from somebody who you really believed in, it hurts so much more. And I think that that's the experience that a lot of Americans have had with the Democratic Party. I think they had it under Obama with the recession in particular. And so, like, with Trump, I mean, sometimes I feel like he's just subbing for a fantasy of just, he's bringing back things that people don't even realize are lost. Like, I look at his rallies and I see, like, the Arena Rock of the 1980s, or I see, like, a WWE match, or all these big social gatherings that people just think are full of energy and they're fun and they're angry and they're a way for people to get their emotions out. And so, you know, I kind of get it. I mean, he's completely full of it. You know, he's just lying incessantly, but he's tapping into something that's real. And there's, like, a moment I'll never forget from when he was running in 2016. And at that point, you know, my husband had lost his job and I had two kids under the age of five and I was trying to take care of them and work. And, you know, we barely had any money. And Trump comes out and says that 45% of Americans are unemployed, which is obviously like a nonsensical statistic. Right. Like, technically it was like five. But when he said it, I thought, that's right. That's exactly what it feels like, because everyone I knew was going through problems like this, and it felt like 45%. And then I thought, oh gosh, this is awful, because people are going to relate to what he's saying, even though he's full of it, even though he doesn't care. You know, 45% of the country could be unemployed and he wouldn't care. He's just saying it to tap into that anger, but he does have this instinctual, it's like a vulture looking for prey, you know, looking for animals that are wounded because they're easier, you know, to kill and eat. That's how he fuses Americans, and he's able to hone in, and they think that he's going to soothe them, and then he doesn't. But then they kind of, I'm not sure what they expect of him. Sometimes I feel like it's almost like a transferable kind of impunity. You know, he behaves with utter impunity. He commits crimes all the time, and they'd like to be able to do that too. You know, kind of like what you were saying before, you know, with your dad and con men and stuff, like, people want to have that ability to be a con man, to just do whatever they want, fool people and you know, get to the top in a way that's, you know, unorthodox. And they see Trump doing that and they're like, I would like to be that way. He's telling me I can be that way. I can, right. You know, there's no consequences anymore for anybody. And I think that's kind of an appealing vision when things feel out of control. And I think for a lot of Americans, just for the last decade, not, you know, some of these problems don't even have to do specifically with Trump or Biden or anybody, like stuff like COVID appearing and just, you know, our whole lives getting turned upside down. They feel like things are out of control, and then they look to somebody to rein them in. I'm not quite sure. It's interesting with Trump because he's so, you know, lunatic. I mean, I'm trying to think of a nicer, more diplomatic word, but I don't have one. But that's not who I would, like, go to calm things down. You know what I'm saying? Like, I would not go to Donald Trump to settle down a situation. So, but I don't know. I mean, they may just be, maybe they're gunned up for a fight. Maybe that's the appeal in this case still, even now, 8 years later.
Well, you know, I think you're exactly right, Doctor. And I feel that my dad had that ability. My dad had the ability to talk to you. He was a salesman that never came through on the deal, but he had the ability to talk to you, and he was almost empathetic about the way you felt about things. He could adjust his sales pitch to fit the character he was dealing with. He taught me a lot about sales. I worked my way through college as a salesman and was pretty good at it. But yeah, he could feel that in people. And I see that in Donald Trump today, is this great sense to tap into that type of thing. And let me tell you, Doc, you're pretty profound. Why aren't you running for public office?
Oh God, because I like my life and don't want to torture myself.
We need people like you. Come on. Especially Missouri. You know?
No. I like my Representative Cori Bush, who they're trying to oust. Yeah. And, you know, I have no interest in serving. I'm also, you know, a terrible bureaucrat. I'm a writer. It's awful. It's like whenever, you know, past writers ran, Hunter S. Thompson, Norman Mailer, what have you, it doesn't go well. You do not want us in office. We're terrible, terrible bureaucrats and officials. So just veto this right now.
Well, but, you know, I'm willing to be your campaign manager, and you know, my greatest asset is I work for free. So I used to charge a lot. I've worked on a lot of presidential campaigns, but now I work for free. So you can get me for better than a song.
I like
Missouri. I campaigned in Missouri. I got to tell you, man, I couldn't believe the people. I campaigned
People get Missouri so wrong. And like what you said, I want to emphasize to the audience what you pointed out, that Obama lost by 3,000 votes. That is a very seminal thing to watch. You know, we used to be the bellwether state, and this whole idea of us being this, you know, dark red MAGA land, it's just nuts. We are an example of the American future in kind of the worst way, because we are a hostage state. We are a GOP hostage state that has dark money, gerrymandering, propaganda, all these dirty deals going on, no true representation in a lot of ways, and that is what they want nationally. That is what the GOP is seeking nationally, and we're like this little experiment that they've been working on since about, you know, 2008, because before then, when I moved here, we were really, you know, what you would call a quintessential purple state. You know, we were really kind of half and half, and there wasn't this incredible friction. We spanned the entire ideological spectrum, and I think we still do. You just don't see it in our representation, and you definitely don't see it in our media portrayals, in part because our entire media almost is, you know, gone. It's almost out of business. Another paper just went under last month. And when you're not kind of able to represent yourself on the national stage, people just make up a caricature of you. And that's happened to my state, and it's happened to a lot of other states in the South and the Midwest. And, you know, also, you know, honestly, in the Northeast and the West Coast, too, I think a lot of places are very falsely represented and thought of as richer than they are in the case of, you know, the average person in D.C. or New York, or more conservative than they are in the case of a place like Missouri. Like, we're all a lot more complicated than I think folks, than the media gives us credit for.
Well, I can tell you that I was shocked going to Missouri. I campaigned around the St. Louis area, and I was going to Ohio for Obama when I had a friend in Missouri call me and say, "You don't want to go to Ohio, man. You want to come to Missouri, because that's where the battle." That's where the battle's going to be. And, you know, I remember canvassing for Obama and having people say things to me like, "Well, we're really McCain people, but you look really hot. You want to come in and have some lemonade?" I'm like, I'm from Washington, D.C. If you came up to my door and said you were for McCain, we would sick the dog on you. You know,
that's right. We
don't say, you know, yeah, we don't agree with you, but you know, we're not. They were some of the nicest people I ever met. I gotta be honest with you. And I was just floored by that. And I think we do that. I think if Kamala Harris has one thing that's going to work against her, it's being from California, because of what you say. You know, we have that image of California people as being really radical. You know, they live on the sides of mountains. They, you know, all listen to rock and roll music and smoke pot and hang around and, you know, dream of a better world. So that may be an image that she has to overcome.
Or just the wealth, I think. In Missouri, people think California, they think wealthy. And they also think, I mean, the largest number, I think the state with the most Republicans in it is technically California, in part because the population is so large. But also, it's not as liberal as people think. The same way with Texas, I think that state has the largest number of Democrats, again, because it's so large. And it's kind of, you know, 50-50, and they have a gerrymandering issue and whatnot. But yeah, it's a real mixed bag over there. I think, you know, Kamala Harris's association with a lot of really elite entities, whether it's courts or Silicon Valley or Nancy Pelosi or whatever, those sorts of associations, I think folks aren't really going to like that, you know, less so than sort of thinking she's too radical or something, which is why I'm hoping she does pick, you know, Waltz or Beshear or somebody else from the Midwest or South, not even because of what they'll do for that state, you know, as the VP candidate, but because the broad region will feel like that's a guy who at least understands how we live here. Like, what is day-to-day life here? Like, they know that we're not full of angry Trump voters in diners the way the New York Times always writes about places like this. You know, they know what it's actually like. Whereas if they pick somebody like Shapiro from Philadelphia, which is, you know, kind of in that nexus of New York, D.C., I think that it'll feel like, oh gosh, you know, the whole middle of the country once again is getting neglected by both parties, really. Well, that's the thing. They'll try to pivot to J.D. Vance, but he's such a phony. I just don't think people are going to, I mean, they're already not falling for it. But they will say, you know, he's from Ohio. Like, he is, you know, from another part of the country that is underrepresented in our political discourse. And they'll try to beat that drum. I mean, it's all amazing to me that this is coming from a guy who literally lives in a golden tower in a skyscraper in New York City, and then has marketed himself as a man of the people. Like, it's just, you know, it's nuts to me that he continues to pull that one off. But, I'm just a poor millionaire from Queens.
It says something when moving into the White House is downsizing, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're moving out of your 50,000 square foot apartment at Mar-a-Lago to move into, you know, a bungalow in Washington, D.C. But it really is perplexing. I got to tell you, can we talk for a second, because you studied this, about digital media as a tool for fascism? I mean, is that really important? Because you can go down these rabbit holes and get all sorts of positive reinforcement for your ideas, regardless of how crazy they are. You know,
yes.
We had my former employee worked part time at Comet Pizza, and I don't know if you remember, Comet Pizza was a place.
Oh yeah, no, I wrote about it a little bit, and the shooting
right, and they're still talking about it, you know, and it was crazy. It was crazy. It's an institution here in Washington. We all go there with our kids. The guy that put it together, James Alfonte, is brilliant. He put ping pong tables in a pizza parlor, so your kids have something to do while they're waiting for the pizza rather than, you know, bothering you. And they make great pizza. And, you know, we're just flabbergasted that people believe that. And a guy came up there with an AR-15 rifle and shot up the place. And let me ask you this question. I mean, I've been meaning to ask you this. Why isn't the media saying anything about the fact that he was shot with an AR-15 rifle, which the Republican Party for years has, you know, said we should, you know, everybody in America should have one? Why don't they report on that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And honestly, this entire assassination episode is so bizarre and prompts so many questions. And I think the only reason maybe that it was kind of dropped is because Biden, you know, left the race about 5 days later, and then Kamala came in, and there was just that, you know, everything was kind of forgotten in the midst of all of that chaos. But, you know, there are questions about what was the Secret Service doing? Why did they not capture the shooter? Why was the shooter allowed to get close? What happened to Trump's ear? You know, and I don't want to have like ear gate where we're all like looking. I mean, you know, there are many things in my life I'd like to do, and like staring at images of Trump's ear is not one of them. But, you know, it's weird. Like, was he hit? Was he not hit? Like, can't somebody give like a straight answer on that? And either way, it's creating an image of assassination. This is what worries me, as kind of like a thing that happens, a normal thing. Because for about half the country, for basically anybody like under the age of 50, we don't remember any presidential assassination attempts. Like, I was too young to remember Reagan, you know, and so I think, you know, maybe people in their early 50s can remember that. Anyone younger, it's not in our mind. Now that sort of seed has been planted, and I worry that it'll lead to, you know, to more. But yeah, I do think it's strange. I think, of course, the Republicans aren't going to talk about gun control, even if it's targeting one of their own, because they never do. But I'm kind of wondering why the Democrats aren't bringing it up. And I mean, I do basically attribute it to, we've had this huge shift, you know, another unprecedented event for most people is having the leading candidate drop out, you know, which hasn't happened since LBJ. So we don't know what that's like. And it's been very unnerving, a very chaotic last 30 days. And of course, when Trump is the other candidate, it's always chaotic. So yeah, but I do hope people go back and look at it, because I don't understand how it happened, and it worries me more as a broad security issue in a country like ours where so many people are armed and where they're encouraged to be armed and, you know, whole industries are built around them being armed. Why is this not being scrutinized more closely, and why is Trump not more unnerved? You know, this is not a brave man. Like, people really get that wrong about him. He's sort of, I don't know, he's savvy. He's like you say, he's a con artist. He's savvy. He's prepared in that regard. He's not somebody who reacts well to surprise. He likes everything to be scripted. This is why he did reality TV, why he fed stories about himself to tabloids. He likes to know what's coming. And usually if there's something genuinely surprising, he acts as if he's deeply unnerved. And he hasn't been acting that way at all. He just went straight to profiteering off of that photo, which, you know, in a sense is not, that is very typical Trump. But I'm sort of taken aback. You know, before COVID, he was known for being so afraid of dying, so afraid of getting sick that, you know, there was an article about him in Politico called, like, that hand lotion Prevel or something like that. That's not right. That's a cheese from St. Louis. Right. But, you know, anyway, he was known for obsessively washing his hands and putting on antibacterial lotion to make sure he never caught a disease. And then suddenly when COVID appeared, he abandoned that, which is strange in its own right. But I would think he just would be more shaken up, more kind of maybe even reluctant to participate in the public domain the way he does without more safety precautions. But he seems fine. He seems unconcerned. And that is strange for him. You know, you think he would be constantly trying to portray himself as a martyr and so forth. But it's almost like he dropped it. And that's very uncharacteristic, especially when he's trying to make money off of that photo. So, yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah, a lot of mysteries there.
Yeah, there really is. And it's really a phenomenon that I think will be studied by academics for decades, how all this came to be and how he's managed to flourish, at least with this group of this large group of the American population. And we need to worry about it. What do you think about this happening all over the world? I mean, we have this guy in India, Modi. We have a guy like him in Argentina. We have a guy like him in North Korea. We have a guy like him in the Soviet Union. I mean, in Russia now, there is no Soviet Union. But
once KGB, always KGB, I think, when it comes to Putin. So,
right, exactly. Yeah. You know, and I don't know if you saw the front page of the Washington Post today. It's priceless, where Putin has said that it's your patriotic duty to have children, women's patriotic duty to have children, to build up the Russian population, and they have all this picture of all these bewildered looking Russian women on the front of the Washington Post, like they're all thinking, what did he say? Do what? You know,
yeah.
I mean, it really is something. Well, we're running out of time here, and I want to ask you before you leave, What do you want to say that I haven't asked you? What would you like to add to all this?
Is there anything? Oh gosh, well, we've covered
including
a
website.
I mean,
if you have one, go ahead.
I have a Substack. I have a newsletter that's actually free. You can subscribe. It's still all free. You don't have to pay for it. Sarah Kenzier, just my name at Substack. I'm also on Twitter. You know, I just kind of warn folks that the next 6 months in particular, I think, are going to be chaotic, difficult, hopefully not violent, but possibly violent. And just think to yourself now, even write it down, like, what are your values? What are your morals? What are some things that you would never, ever do because they're wrong and you know that they're wrong? And then just sort of keep track of that as the months go on, because I think there's going to be a lot of challenges and a lot of pressure for people to accept things that they normally would find utterly unacceptable under different circumstances. And I think we all have to stand our moral ground and retain that integrity. And that if we're able to do that individually, I think collectively for the common good, that will be very beneficial to our country, just to, you know, not get sucked into these propaganda mills, into these memes, into these algorithms, into all these things that are trying to construct our thoughts and replace our thoughts even. So I guess that's what I would tell your audience.
Well, that's a great way to end, Doc. I think that's great advice. And by the way, reconsider running for public office. Look, you've raised children. What worse can, you know, you've been through the battle already, right? I had three, I like to say I raised three children. It's not true. I watched my wife raise them, and I paid for them. But you know, it makes you tough, right? I think.
Oh, yeah. But they're like wonderful, though. That's the thing. I love them too much to run for office. I want to get to hang out with them and retain their privacy and, you know, all that.
That's the problem with motherhood, isn't it? They get all gooey about it, and you know. But anyway, thanks so much for being on the show. I hope you come back sometime. Maybe the next show we'll have is when we have a new president and it's not Donald Trump, and you and I can celebrate. Okay,
that would be terrific.
Thanks so much for taking time out to be with us today. And folks,
thank you.
We always end the show by playing out with a song. And tonight, I got to dedicate this to a dear friend of mine. We lost a dear friend, Keith Silver, last week. And Keith was an amazing man who was a personal assistant to the Temptations, to Eddie Kendricks. He was a friend of the King family. He ran the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the group that Dr. Martin Luther King started here in Washington. He was a personal friend and an assistant to one of my mentors, Dick Gregory. So this goes out to the memory of Keith. We're going to miss you, buddy. You are an amazing person. Here's Eddie Kendricks with a song that we should all take to heart. Thank you. We'll see you next week.
Give the people their right to vote.